Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution, by Michael J. Behe, narrated by Mark William. Preface: A Molecular Phenomenon. It is commonplace, almost banal, to say that science has made great strides in understanding nature. The laws of physics are now so well understood that space probes fly unerringly to photograph worlds billions of miles from Earth. Computers, telephones, electric lights, and untold other examples testify to the mastery of science and technology over the forces of nature. Vaccines and high-yield crops have stayed the ancient enemies of mankind, disease and hunger, at least in parts of the world. Almost weekly, announcements of discoveries in molecular biology encourage the hope of cures for genetic diseases and more. Yet understanding how something works is not the same as understanding how it came to be. For example, the motions of the planets in the solar system can be predicted with tremendous accuracy. However, the origin of the solar system, the question of how the sun, planets, and their moons formed in the first place, is still controversial. Science may eventually solve the riddle. Still, the point remains that understanding the origin of something is different from understanding its day-to-day workings. Science's mastery of nature has led many people to presume that it can, indeed must, also explain the origin of nature and life. Darwin's proposal that life can be explained by natural selection acting on variation has been overwhelmingly accepted in educated circles for more than a century, even though the basic mechanisms of life remained utterly mysterious until several decades ago. Modern science has learned that, ultimately, life is a molecular phenomenon. All organisms are made of molecules that act as the nuts and bolts, gears and pulleys of biological systems. Certainly there are complex biological features, such as the circulation of blood, that emerge at higher levels, but the gritty details of life are the province of biomolecules. Therefore, the science of biochemistry, which studies those molecules, has as its mission the exploration of the very foundation of life. Since the mid-1950s, biochemistry has painstakingly elucidated the workings of life at the molecular level. Darwin was ignorant of the reason for variation within a species, one of the requirements of his theory, but biochemistry has identified the molecular basis for it. 19th-century science could not even guess at the mechanism of vision, immunity, or movement, but modern biochemistry has identified the molecules that allow those and other functions. It was once expected that the basis of life would be exceedingly simple. That expectation has been smashed. Vision, motion, and other biological functions have proven to be no less sophisticated than television cameras and automobiles. Science has made enormous progress in understanding how the chemistry of life works, but the elegance and complexity of biological systems at the molecular level have paralyzed science's attempt to explain their origins. There has been virtually no attempt to account for the origin of specific, complex biomolecular systems, much less any progress. Many scientists have gamely asserted that explanations are already in hand, or will be sooner or later, but no support for such assertions can be found in the professional science literature. More importantly, there are compelling reasons, based on the structure of the systems themselves, to think that a Darwinian explanation for the mechanisms of life will forever prove elusive. Evolution is a flexible word. It can be used by one person to mean something as simple as change over time, or by another person to mean the descent of all life forms from a common ancestor, leaving the mechanism of change unspecified. In its full-throated biological sense, however, evolution means a process whereby life arose from non-living matter and subsequently developed entirely by natural means. That is the sense that Darwin gave to the word, and the meaning that it holds in the scientific community. And that is the sense in which I use the word evolution throughout this book. Apologia for details. Several years ago, Santa Claus gave my oldest son a plastic tricycle for Christmas. Ultimately, busy man that he is, Santa had no time to take it out of the box and assemble it before heading off. The task fell to Dad. I took the parts out of the box, unfolded the assembly instructions, and sighed. There were 6 pages of detailed instructions. Line up the 8 different types of screws, insert 2 1.5-inch screws through the handle into the shaft, stick the shaft through the square hole in the body of the bike, and so on. I didn't want to even read the instructions, because I knew they couldn't be skimmed like a newspaper. The whole purpose is in the details. But I rolled up my sleeves, opened a can of beer, and set to work. After several hours, the tricycle was assembled. In the process, I had indeed read every single instruction in the booklet several times to drill them into my head and performed the exact actions that the instructions required. My aversion to instructions seems to be widespread. Although most households own a video cassette recorder, VCR, most folks cannot program them. These technological wonders come with complete operating instructions, but the very thought of tediously studying each sentence of the booklet makes most people delegate the job to the nearest 10-year-old. Unfortunately, much of biochemistry is like an instruction booklet, in the sense that the importance is in the details. A student of biochemistry who merely skims through a biochemistry textbook is virtually certain to spend much of the next exam staring at the ceiling as drops of sweat trickle down his or her forehead. Skimming the textbook does not prepare a student for questions such as, outline in detail the mechanism for hydrolysis of a peptide bond by trypsin, paying special attention to the role of transition state binding energy. Although there are broad principles of biochemistry that help a mortal comprehend the general picture of the chemistry of life, broad principles only take you so far. A degree in engineering does not substitute for the tricycle instruction booklet, nor does it directly help you to program your VCR. Many people, unfortunately, are all too aware of the pickiness of biochemistry. People who suffer with sickle cell anemia, enduring much pain in their shortened lives, know the importance of the little detail that changed 1 out of 146 amino acid residues in 1 out of the tens of thousands of proteins in their body. The parents of children who die of Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis, or who suffer from diabetes or hemophilia, know more than they want to about the importance of biochemical details. So, as a writer who wants people to read my work, I face a dilemma. People hate to read details, yet the story of the impact of biochemistry on evolutionary theory rests solely in the details. Therefore, I have to write the kind of book people don't like to read in order to persuade them of the ideas that push me to write. Nonetheless, complexity must be experienced to be appreciated. So, gentle listener, I beg your patience. There are going to be a lot of details in this book. The book is divided into 3 parts. Part 1 gives some background and explains why evolution must now be argued at the molecular level, the domain of the science of biochemistry. This portion is largely free from technical details, although some do creep in during a discussion of the eye. Part 2 contains the example chapters, where most of the complexity is found. Part 3 is a non-technical discussion of the implications of biochemistry's discoveries. So, the hard stuff is confined mostly to Part 2. In that section, however, I liberally use analogies to familiar everyday objects to get the ideas across, and even in that section, detailed descriptions of biochemical systems are minimized. Some listeners may plow right through Part 2. Others, however, may wish to skim the section or even skip parts, then return when they're ready to absorb more. For those who want a deeper understanding of biochemistry, I have included an appendix outlining some general biochemical principles. I encourage those who want all the details to borrow an introductory biochemistry text from the library. Part 1. The Box is opened. Chapter 1. Lilliputian Biology. The Limits of an Idea. This book is about an idea, Darwinian evolution, that is being pushed to its limits by discoveries in biochemistry. Biochemistry is the study of the very basis of life, the molecules that make up cells and tissues that catalyze the chemical reactions of digestion, photosynthesis, immunity, and more. The astonishing progress made by biochemistry since the mid-1950s is a monumental tribute to science's power to understand the world. It has brought many practical benefits in medicine and agriculture. We may have to pay a price, though, for our knowledge. When foundations are unearthed, the structures that rest on them are shaken. Sometimes they collapse. When sciences such as physics finally uncovered their foundations, old ways of understanding the world had to be tossed out, extensively revised, or restricted to a limited part of nature. Will this happen to the theory of evolution by natural selection? Like many great ideas, Darwin's is elegantly simple. He observed that there is variation in all species. Some members are bigger, some smaller, some faster, some lighter in color, and so forth. He reasoned that since limited food supplies could not support all organisms that are born, the ones whose chance variation gave them an advantage in the struggle for life would tend to survive and reproduce, outcompeting the less favored ones. If the variation were inherited, then the characteristics of the species would change over time. Over great periods, great changes might occur. For more than a century, most scientists have thought that virtually all of life, or at least all of its most interesting features, resulted from natural selection working on random variation. Darwin's idea has been used to explain finch beaks and horse hooves, moth coloration and insect slaves, and the distribution of life around the globe and through the ages. The theory has even been stretched by some scientists to interpret human behavior, why desperate people commit suicide, why teenagers have babies out of wedlock, why some groups do better on intelligence tests than other groups, and why religious missionaries forego marriage and children. There is nothing, no organ or idea, no sense or thought, that has not been the subject of evolutionary rumination. Almost a century and a half after Darwin proposed his theory, evolutionary biology has had much success in accounting for patterns of life we see around us. To many, its triumph seems complete. But the real work of life does not happen at the level of the whole animal or organ. The most important parts of living things are too small to be seen. Life is lived in the details, and it is molecules that handle life's details. Darwin's idea might explain horse hooves, but can it explain life's foundation? Shortly after 1950, science advanced to the point where it could determine the shapes and properties of a few of the molecules that make up living organisms. Slowly, painstakingly, the structures of more and more biological molecules were elucidated, and the way they work inferred from countless experiments. The cumulative results show with piercing clarity that life is based on machines, machines made of molecules. Molecular machines haul cargo from one place in the cell to another along highways made of other molecules, while still others act as cables, ropes, and pulleys to hold the cell in shape. Machines turn cellular switches on and off, sometimes killing the cell or causing it to grow. Solar-powered machines capture the energy of photons and store it in chemicals. Electrical machines allow current to flow through nerves. Manufacturing machines build other molecular machines, as well as themselves. Cells swim using machines, copy themselves with machinery, ingest food with machinery. In short, highly sophisticated molecular machines control every cellular process. Thus, the details of life are finely calibrated, and the machinery of life enormously complex. Can all of life be fit into Darwin's theory of evolution? Because the popular media likes to publish exciting stories, and because some scientists enjoy speculating about how far their discoveries might go, it has been difficult for the public to separate fact from conjecture. To find the real evidence, you have to dig into the journals and books published by the scientific community itself. The scientific literature reports experiments firsthand, and the reports are generally free of the flights of fancy that make their way into the spin-offs that follow. But as I will note later, if you search the scientific literature on evolution, and if you focus your search on the question of how molecular machines, the basis of life, developed, you find an eerie and complete silence. The complexity of life's foundation has paralyzed science's attempt to account for it. Molecular machines raise an as-yet impenetrable barrier to Darwinism's universal reach. To find out why, in this book I will examine several fascinating molecular machines, then ask whether they can ever be explained by random mutation or natural selection. Evolution is a controversial topic, so it is necessary to address a few basic questions at the beginning of the book. Many people think that questioning Darwinian evolution must be equivalent to espousing creationism. As commonly understood, creationism involves belief in an earth formed only about 10,000 years ago, an interpretation of the Bible that is still very popular. For the record, I have no reason to doubt that the universe is the billions of years old that physicists say it is. Further, I find the idea of common descent, that all organisms share a common ancestor, fairly convincing, and have no particular reason to doubt it. I greatly respect the work of my colleagues who study the development and behavior of organisms within an evolutionary framework, and I think that evolutionary biologists have contributed enormously to our understanding of the world. Although Darwin's mechanism, natural selection working on variation, might explain many things, however, I do not believe it explains molecular life. I also do not think it surprising that the new science of the very small might change the way we view the less small. A very brief history of biology. When things are going smoothly in our lives, most of us tend to think that the society we live in is natural, and that our ideas about the world are self-evidently true. It's hard to imagine how other people in other times and places lived as they did, or why they believed the things they did. During periods of upheaval, however, when apparently solid verities are questioned, it can seem as if nothing in the world makes sense. During those times, history can remind us that the search for reliable knowledge is a long, difficult process that has not yet reached an end. In order to develop a perspective from which we can view the idea of Darwinian evolution, over the next few pages I will very briefly outline the history of biology. In a way, this history has been a chain of black boxes. As one is opened, another is revealed. Black box is a whimsical term for a device that does something, but whose inner workings are mysterious, sometimes because the workings can't be seen, and sometimes because they just aren't comprehensible. Computers are a good example of a black box. Most of us use these marvelous machines without the vaguest idea of how they work, processing words or plotting graphs or playing games in contented ignorance of what is going on underneath the outer case. Even if we were to remove the cover, though, few of us could make heads or tails of the jumble of pieces inside. There is no simple, observable connection between the parts of the computer and the things that it does. Imagine that a computer with a long-lasting battery was transported back in time 1,000 years to King Arthur's court. How would people of that era react to a computer in action? Most would be in awe, but with luck, someone might want to understand the thing. Someone might notice that letters appeared on the screen as he or she touched the keys. Some combinations of letters, corresponding to computer commands, might make the screen change. After a while, many commands would be figured out. Our medieval Englishmen might believe they had unlocked the secrets of the computer. But eventually somebody would remove the cover and gaze on the computer's inner workings. Suddenly, the theory of how a computer works would be revealed as profoundly naive. The black box that had been slowly decoded would have exposed another black box. In ancient times, all of biology was a black box, because no one understood on even the broadest level how living things worked. The ancients who gaped at a plant or animal and wondered just how the thing worked were in the presence of unfathomable technology. They were truly in the dark. The earliest biological investigations began in the only way they could, with the naked eye. A number of books from about 400 BC, attributed to Hippocrates, the father of medicine, describe the symptoms of some common diseases and attribute sickness to diet and other physical causes rather than to the work of the gods. Although the writings were a beginning, the ancients were still lost when it came to the composition of living things. They believed that all matter was made up of four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. Living bodies were thought to be made of four humors: blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm, and all disease supposedly arose from an excess of one of the humors. The greatest biologist of the Greeks was also their greatest philosopher, Aristotle. Born when Hippocrates was still alive, Aristotle realized, unlike almost everyone before him, that knowledge of nature requires systematic observation. Through careful examination, he recognized an astounding amount of order within the living world, a crucial first step. Aristotle grouped animals into two general categories, those with blood and those without, that correspond closely to the modern classifications of vertebrate and invertebrate. Within the vertebrates, he recognized the categories of mammals, birds, and fish. He put most amphibians and reptiles in a single group, and snakes in a separate class. Even though his observations were unaided by instruments, much of Aristotle's reasoning remains sound, despite the knowledge gained in the thousands of years since he died. Only a few significant biological investigators lived during the millennium following Aristotle. One of them was Galen, a 2nd century AD physician in Rome. Galen's work shows that careful observation of the outside and, with dissection, the inside of plants and animals, although necessary, is not sufficient to comprehend biology. For example, Galen tried to understand the function of animal organs. Although he knew that the heart pumped blood, he could not tell just from looking that the blood circulated and returned to the heart. Galen mistakenly thought that blood was pumped out to irrigate the tissues, and that new blood was made continuously to resupply the heart. His idea was taught for nearly 1,500 years. It was not until the 17th century that an Englishman, William Harvey, introduced the theory that blood flows continuously in one direction, making a complete circuit and returning to the heart. Harvey calculated that if the heart pumps out just 2 ounces of blood per beat, at 72 beats per minute, in 1 hour it would have pumped 540 pounds of blood, triple the weight of a man. Since making that much blood in so short a time is clearly impossible, the blood had to be reused. Harvey's logical reasoning, aided by the still new Arabic numerals, which made calculating easy, in support of an unobservable activity, was unprecedented. It set the stage for modern biological thought. In the Middle Ages, the pace of scientific investigation quickened. The examples set by Aristotle had been followed by increasing numbers of naturalists. Many plants were described by the early botanists Brunfels, Bach, Fuchs, and Valerius Cordus. Scientific illustration developed as Rondelet drew animal life in detail. The encyclopedists, such as Conrad Gessner, published large volumes summarizing all of biological knowledge. Linnaeus greatly extended Aristotle's work of classification, inventing the categories of class, order, genus, and species. Studies of comparative biology showed many similarities between diverse branches of life, and the idea of common descent began to be discussed. Biology advanced rapidly in the 17th and 18th centuries as scientists combined Aristotle's and Harvey's examples of attentive observation and clever reasoning. Yet even the strictest attention and cleverest reasoning will take you only so far if important parts of a system aren't visible. Although the human eye can resolve objects as small as 0.1 millimeter, a lot of the action in life occurs on a micro level, a Lilliputian scale. So, biology reached a plateau. One black box, the gross structure of organisms, was opened, only to reveal the black box of the finer levels of life. In order to proceed further, biology needed a series of technological breakthroughs. The first was the microscope. Black boxes within black boxes. Lenses were known in ancient times, and by the 15th century their use in spectacles was common. It was not until the 17th century, however, that a convex and a concave lens were put together in a tube to form the first crude microscope. Galileo used one of the first instruments, and he was amazed to discover the compound eyes of insects. Stalutti looked at the eyes, tongue, antennae, and other parts of bees and weevils. Malpighi confirmed the circulation of the blood through capillaries, and he described the early development of the embryonic chick heart. Nehemiah Grew inspected plants, Schwammerdam dissected the mayfly, Leeuwenhoek was the first person ever to see a bacterial cell, and Robert Hooke described cells in cork and leaves, although their importance escaped him. The discovery of an unanticipated Lilliputian world had begun, overturning settled notions of what living things are. Charles Singer, the historian of science, noted that the infinite complexity of living things thus revealed was as philosophically disturbing as the ordered majesty of the astronomical world which Galileo had unveiled to the previous generation, though it took far longer for its implications to sink into men's minds. In other words, sometimes the new boxes demand that we revise all of our theories. In such cases, great unwillingness can arise. The cell theory of life was finally put forward in the early 19th century by Matthias Schleiden and Theodor Schwann. Schleiden worked primarily with plant tissue. He argued for the central importance of a dark spot, the nucleus, within all cells. Schwann concentrated on animal tissue, in which it was harder to see cells. Nonetheless, he discerned that animals were similar to plants in their cellular structure. Schwann concluded that cells, or the secretions of cells, compose the entire bodies of animals and plants, and that in some way the cells are individual units with a life of their own. He wrote that the question as to the fundamental power of organized bodies resolves itself into that of individual cells. As Schleiden added, thus the primary question is, what is the origin of this peculiar little organism, the cell? Schleiden and Schwann worked in the early to middle 1800s, the time of Darwin's travels and the writing of The Origin of Species. To Darwin, then, as to every other scientist of the time, the cell was a black box. Nonetheless, he was able to make sense of much biology above the level of the cell. The idea that life evolves was not original with Darwin, but he argued it by far the most systematically, and the theory of how evolution works, by natural selection working on variation, was his own. Meanwhile, the cellular black box was steadily explored. The investigation of the cell pushed the microscope to its limits, which are set by the wavelength of light. For physical reasons, a microscope cannot resolve two points that are closer together than approximately one half of the wavelength of the light that is illuminating them. Since the wavelength of visible light is roughly 1/10 the diameter of a bacterial cell, many small critical details of cell structure simply cannot be seen with a light microscope. The black box of the cell could not be opened without further technological improvements. In the late 19th century, as physics progressed rapidly, J.J. Thomson discovered the electron. The invention of the electron microscope followed several decades later. Because the wavelength of the electron is shorter than the wavelength of visible light, much smaller objects can be resolved if they are illuminated with electrons. Electron microscopy has a number of practical difficulties, not least of which is the tendency of the electron beam to fry the sample. But ways were found to get around the problems, and after World War...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?